peculiar in her venerable friend's look and tone, insomuch that she gazed into his face with considerable earnestness, endeavoring to discover what secret meaning, if any, might be lurking there. Individuals whose affairs have reached an utterly desperate crisis almost invariably keep themselves alive with hopes, so much the more airily magnificent as they have the less of solid matter within their grasp whereof to mould any judicious and moderate expectation of good. Thus, all the while Hepzibah was perfecting the scheme of her little shop, she had cherished an unacknowledged idea that some harlequin trick of fortune would intervene in her favor. For example, an uncle, who had sailed for India 50 years before and never been heard of since, might yet return and adopt her to be the comfort of his very extreme and decrepit age, and adorn her with pearls, diamonds, and oriental shawls and turbans, and make her the ultimate heiress of his unreckonable riches. Or the Member of Parliament, now at the head of the English branch of the family, with which the elder stock on this side of the Atlantic had held little or no intercourse for the last 2 centuries, this eminent gentleman might invite Hepzibah to quit the ruinous House of the Seven Gables and come over to dwell with her kindred at Pynchon Hall. But for reasons the most imperative, she could not yield to his request. It was more probable, therefore, that the descendants of a Pynchon who had emigrated to Virginia in some past generation and become a great planter there, hearing of Hepzibah's destitution and impelled by the splendid generosity of character with which their Virginian mixture must have enriched the New England blood, would send her a remittance of $1,000 with a hint of repeating the favor annually. Or, and surely anything so undeniably just could not be beyond the limits of reasonable anticipation, the great claim to the heritage of Waldo County might finally be decided in favor of the Pynchons, so that instead of keeping a cent shop, Hepzibah would build a palace and look down from its highest tower on hill, dale, forest, field, and town as her own share of the ancestral territory. These were some of the fantasies which she had long dreamed about, and aided by these, Uncle Venner's casual attempt at encouragement kindled a strange festal glory in the poor, bare, melancholy chambers of her brain, as if that inner world were suddenly lighted up with gas. But either he knew nothing of her castles in the air, as how should he, or else her earnest scowl disturbed his recollection, as it might a more courageous man's. Instead of pursuing any weightier topic, Uncle Venner was pleased to favor Hepzibah with some sage counsel in her shopkeeping capacity. "Give no credit," these were some of his golden maxims. "Never take paper money. Look well to your change. Ring the silver on the 4-pound weight. Shove back all English halfpence and base copper tokens, such as are very plenty about town. At your leisure hours, knit children's woolen socks and mittens. Brew your own yeast, and make your own ginger beer." And while Hepzibah was doing her utmost to digest the hard little pellets of his already uttered wisdom, he gave vent to his final and what he declared to be his all-important advice, as follows. "Put on a bright face for your customers, and smile pleasantly as you hand them what they ask for. A stale article, if you dip it in a good warm sunny smile, will go off better than a fresh one that you've scowled upon." To this last apothegm, poor Hepzibah responded with a sigh so deep and heavy that it almost rustled Uncle Venner quite away like a withered leaf, as he was, before an autumnal gale. Recovering himself, however, he bent forward, and with a good deal of feeling in his ancient visage, beckoned her nearer to him.
"When do you expect him home?" whispered he.
"Whom do you mean?" asked Hepzibah, turning pale.
"Ah, you don't love to talk about it," said Uncle Venner. Well, we'll say no more, though there's word of it all over town. I remember him, Miss Hepzibah, before he could run alone."
During the remainder of the day, poor Hepzibah acquitted herself even less creditably as a shopkeeper than in her earlier efforts. She appeared to be walking in a dream, or more truly, the vivid life and reality assumed by her emotions made all outward occurrences insubstantial, like the teasing phantasms of a half-conscious slumber. She still responded mechanically to the frequent summons of the shop bell, and at the demand of her customers went prying with vague eyes about the shop, proffering them one article after another, and thrusting aside, perversely, as most of them supposed, the identical thing they asked for. There is sad confusion, indeed, when the spirit thus flits away into the past, or into the more awful future, or in any manner steps across the spaceless boundary betwixt its own region and the actual world, where the body remains to guide itself as best it may, with little more than the mechanism of animal life. It is like death, without death's quiet privilege, its freedom from mortal care. Worst of all, when the actual duties are comprised in such petty details as now vex the brooding soul of the old gentlewoman. As the animosity of fate would have it, there was a great influx of custom in the course of the afternoon. Hepzibah blundered to and fro about her small place of business, committing the most unheard-of errors, now stringing up 12 and now 7 tallow candles instead of 10 to the pound, selling ginger for Scotch snuff, pins for needles and needles for pins, misreckoning her change, sometimes to the public detriment and much oftener to her own, and thus she went on, doing her utmost to bring chaos back again, until, at the close of the day's labor, to her inexplicable astonishment, she found the money drawer almost destitute of coin. After all her painful traffic, the whole proceeds were perhaps 6 coppers, and a questionable 9, which ultimately proved to be copper likewise. At this price, or at whatever price, she rejoiced that the day had reached its end. Never before had she had such a sense of the intolerable length of time that creeps between dawn and sunset, and of the miserable irksomeness of having aught to do, and of the better wisdom that it would be to lie down at once in sullen resignation and let life and its toils and vexations trample over one's prostrate body as they may. Hepzibah's final operation was with the little devourer of Jim Crow and the elephant, who now proposed to eat a camel. In her bewilderment, she offered him first a wooden dragoon, and next a handful of marbles, neither of which being adapted to his else omnivorous appetite, she hastily held out her whole remaining stock of natural history in gingerbread, and huddled the small customer out of the shop. She then muffled the bell in an unfinished stocking and put up the oaken bar across the door. During the latter process, an omnibus came to a standstill under the branches of the elm tree. Hepzibah's heart was in her mouth. Remote and dusky and with no sunshine on all the intervening space was that region of the past whence her only guest might be expected to arrive. Was she to meet him now? Somebody, at all events, was passing from the farthest interior of the omnibus towards its entrance. A gentleman alighted, but it was only to offer his hand to a young girl, whose slender figure, nowise needing such assistance, now lightly descended the steps and made an airy little jump from the final one to the sidewalk. She rewarded her cavalier with a smile, the cheery glow of which was seen reflected on his own face as he re-entered the vehicle. The girl then turned towards the house of the 7 gables, to the door of which, meanwhile, not the shop door, but the antique portal, the omnibusman had carried a light trunk and a bandbox. First giving a sharp rap of the old iron knocker, he left his passenger and her luggage at the doorstep and departed. "Who can it be?" thought Hepzibah, who had been screwing her visual organs into the acutest focus of which they were capable. The girl must have mistaken the house. She stole softly into the hall, and herself invisible, gazed through the dusty side-lights of the portal at the young, blooming, and very cheerful face which presented itself for admittance into the gloomy old mansion. It was a face to which almost any door would have opened of its own accord. The young girl, so fresh, so unconventional, and yet so orderly and obedient to common rules, as you at once recognized her to be, was widely in contrast at that moment with everything about her. The sordid and ugly luxuriance of gigantic weeds that grew in the angle of the house, and the heavy projection that overshadowed her, and the time-worn framework of the door, none of these things belonged to her sphere. But even as a ray of sunshine, fall into what dismal place it may, instantaneously creates for itself a propriety in being there, so did it seem altogether fit that the girl should be standing at the threshold. It was no less evidently proper that the door should swing open to admit her. The maiden lady herself, sternly inhospitable in her first purposes, soon began to feel that the door ought to be shoved back, and the rusty key be turned in the reluctant lock. "Can it be Phoebe?" questioned she within herself. "It must be little Phoebe, for it can be nobody else, and there is a look of her father about her, too. But what does she want here? And how like a country cousin to come down upon a poor body in this way without so much as a day's notice or asking whether she would be welcome? Well, she must have a night's lodging, I suppose, and tomorrow the child shall go back to her mother." Phoebe, it must be understood, was that one little offshoot of the Pynchon race to whom we have already referred as a native of the rural part of New England, where the old fashions and feelings of relationship are still partially kept up. In her own circle it was regarded as by no means improper for kinsfolk to visit one another without invitation or preliminary and ceremonious warning. Yet, in consideration of Miss Hepzibah's recluse way of life, a letter had actually been written and dispatched, conveying information of Phoebe's projected visit. This epistle, for 3 or 4 days past, had been in the pocket of the penny postman, who, happening to have no other business in Pynchon Street, had not yet made it convenient to call at the House of the Seven Gables.
"No, she can stay only one night," said Hepzibah, unbolting the door. "If Clifford were to find her here, it might disturb him."
5. May and November. Phoebe Pynchon slept on the night of her arrival in a chamber that looked down on the garden of the old house. It fronted towards the east, so that at a very seasonable hour a glow of crimson light came flooding through the window and bathed the dingy ceiling and paper hangings in its own hue. There were curtains to Phoebe's bed, a dark antique canopy and ponderous festoons of a stuff which had been rich and even magnificent in its time, but which now brooded over the girl like a cloud, making a night in that one corner, while elsewhere it was beginning to be day. The morning light, however, soon stole into the aperture at the foot of the bed betwixt those faded curtains. Finding the new guest there, with a bloom on her cheeks like the morning's own, and a gentle stir of departing slumber in her limbs, as when an early breeze moves the foliage, the dawn kissed her brow. It was the caress which a dewy maiden, such as the dawn is immortally, gives to her sleeping sister, partly from the impulse of irresistible fondness, and partly as a pretty hint that it is time now to unclose her eyes. At the touch of those lips of light, Phoebe quietly awoke, and for a moment did not recognize where she was, nor how those heavy curtains chanced to be festooned around her. Nothing, indeed, was absolutely plain to her, except that it was now early morning, and that whatever might happen next, it was proper, first of all, to get up and say her prayers. She was the more inclined to devotion from the grim aspect of the chamber and its furniture, especially the tall, stiff chairs, one of which stood close by her bedside, and looked as if some old-fashioned personage had been sitting there all night, and had vanished only just in season to escape discovery. When Phoebe was quite dressed, she peeped out of the window and saw a rose-bush in the garden. Being a very tall one and of luxuriant growth, it had been propped up against the side of the house, and was literally covered with a rare and very beautiful species of white rose. A large portion of them, as the girl afterwards discovered, had blight or mildew at their hearts, but viewed at a fair distance, the whole rosebush looked as if it had been brought from Eden that very summer, together with the mould in which it grew. The truth was, nevertheless, that it had been planted by Alice Pynchon. She was Phoebe's great-great-grand-aunt, in soil which, reckoning only its cultivation as a garden plat, was now unctuous with nearly 200 years of vegetable decay. Growing as they did, however, out of the old earth, the flowers still sent a fresh and sweet incense up to their creator. Nor could it have been the less pure and acceptable because Phoebe's young breath mingled with it as the fragrance floated past the window. Hastening down the creaking and carpetless staircase, she found her way into the garden, gathered some of the most perfect of the roses, and brought them to her chamber. Little Phoebe was one of those persons who possessed their exclusive patrimony, the gift of practical arrangement. It is a kind of natural magic that enables these favored ones to bring out the hidden capabilities of things around them, and particularly to give a look of comfort and habitableness to any place which, for however brief a period, may happen to be their home. A wild hut of underbrush tossed together by wayfarers through the primitive forest would acquire the home aspect by one night's lodging of such a woman, and would retain it long after her quiet figure had disappeared into the surrounding shade. No less a portion of such homely witchcraft was requisite to reclaim, as it were, Phoebe's wasted, cheerless, and dusky chamber, which had been untenanted so long, except by spiders and mice and rats and ghosts, that it was all overgrown with the desolation which watches to obliterate every trace of man's happier hours. What was precisely Phoebe's process, we find it impossible to say. She appeared to have no preliminary design, but gave a touch here and another there, brought some articles of furniture to light and dragged others into the shadow, looped up or let down a window curtain, and in the course of half an hour had fully succeeded in throwing a kindly and hospitable smile over the apartment. No longer ago than the night before, it had resembled nothing so much as the old maid's heart, for there was neither sunshine nor household fire in one nor the other, and, save for ghosts and ghostly reminiscences, not a guest for many years gone by had entered the heart or the chamber. There was still another peculiarity of this inscrutable charm. The bedchamber, no doubt, was a chamber of very great and varied experience, as a scene of human life. The joy of bridal nights had throbbed itself away here. New immortals had first drawn earthly breath here, and here old people had died. But whether it were the white roses, or whatever the subtle influence might be, a person of delicate instinct would have known at once that it was now a maiden's bedchamber, and had been purified of all former evil and sorrow by her sweet breath and happy thoughts. Her dreams of the past night, being such cheerful ones, had exorcised the gloom, and now haunted the chamber in its stead. After arranging matters to her satisfaction, Phoebe emerged from her chamber with a purpose to descend again into the garden. Besides the rosebush, she had observed several other species of flowers growing there in a wilderness of neglect, and obstructing one another's development, as is often the parallel case in human society, by their uneducated entanglement and confusion. At the head of the stairs, however, she met Hepzibah, who, it still being early, invited her into a room which she would probably have called her boudoir, had her education embraced any such French phrase. It was strewn about with a few old books, and a work-basket, and a dusty writing-desk, and had on one side a large black article of furniture of very strange appearance, which the old gentlewoman told Phoebe was a harpsichord. It looked more like a coffin than anything else. And, indeed, not having been played upon or opened for years, there must have been a vast deal of dead music in it, stifled for want of air. Human finger was hardly known to have touched its chords since the days of Alice Pynchon, who had learned the sweet accomplishment of melody in Europe. Hepzibah bade her young guest sit down, and, herself taking a chair nearby, looked as earnestly at Phoebe's trim little figure as if she expected to see right into its springs and motive secrets. "Cousin Phoebe," said she at last, "I really can't see my way clear to keep you with me." These words, however, had not the inhospitable bluntness with which they may strike the reader,
for the two relatives in a talk before bedtime had arrived at a certain degree of mutual understanding. Hepzibah knew enough to enable her to appreciate the circumstances resulting from the second marriage of the girl's mother, which made it desirable for Phoebe to establish herself in another home. Nor did she misinterpret Phoebe's character and the genial activity pervading it, one of the most valuable traits of the true New England woman, which had impelled her forth, as might be said, to seek her fortune, but with a self-respecting purpose to confer as much benefit as she could anywise receive. As one of her nearest kindred, she had naturally betaken herself to Hepzibah, with no idea of forcing herself on her cousin's protection, but only for a visit of a week or two, which might be indefinitely extended, should it prove for the happiness of both. To Hepzibah's blunt observation, therefore, Phoebe replied as frankly and more cheerfully. "Dear cousin, I cannot tell how it will be," said she, "but I really think we may suit one another much better than you suppose."
"You are a nice girl, I see it plainly," continued Hepzibah, "and it is not any question as to that point which makes me hesitate. But, Phoebe, this house of mine is but a melancholy place for a young person to be in. It lets in the wind and rain, and the snow, too, in the garret and upper chambers in winter-time, but it never lets in the sunshine. And as for myself, you see what I am, a dismal and lonesome old woman, for I begin to call myself old, Phoebe, whose temper, I am afraid, is none of the best, and whose spirits are as bad as can be. I cannot make your life pleasant, Cousin Phoebe, neither can I so much as give you bread to eat."
"You will find me a cheerful little body," answered Phoebe, smiling, and yet with a kind of gentle dignity, "and I mean to earn my bread. You know, I have not been brought up a pension. A girl learns many things in a New England village."
"Ah, Phoebe," said Hepzibah, sighing, "your knowledge would do but little for you here. And then it is a wretched thought that you should fling away your young days in a place like this. Those cheeks would not be so rosy after a month or two. Look at my face."
And indeed the contrast was very striking.
"You see how pale I am. It is my idea that the dust and continual decay of these old houses are unwholesome for the lungs."
"There is the garden, the flowers to be taken care of," observed Phoebe. "I should keep myself healthy with exercise in the open air."
"And after all, child," exclaimed Hepzibah, suddenly rising as if to dismiss the subject, "it is not for me to say who shall be a guest or inhabitant of the old pension house. Its master is coming."
"Do you mean Judge Pynchon?" asked Phoebe in surprise.
"Judge Pynchon!" answered her cousin angrily. "He will hardly cross the threshold while I live. No, no. But, Phoebe, you shall see the face of him I speak of."
She went in quest of the miniature, already described, and returned with it in her hand. Giving it to Phoebe, she watched her features narrowly, and with a certain jealousy as to the mode in which the girl would show herself affected by the picture.
"How do you like the face?" asked Hepzibah.
"It is handsome. It is very beautiful," said Phoebe, admiringly. "It is as sweet a face as a man's can be, or ought to be. It has something of a child's expression, and yet not childish, only one feels so very kindly towards him. He ought never to suffer anything. One would bear much for the sake of sparing him toil or sorrow. Who is it, Cousin Hepzibah?"
"Did you never hear,"
whispered her cousin, bending towards her,
"of Clifford Pynchon?"
"Never. I thought there were no Pynchons left except yourself and our cousin Geoffrey," answered Phoebe.
"And yet I seem to have heard the name of Clifford Pynchon. Yes, from my father or my mother. But has he not been a long while dead?" "Well, well, child, perhaps he has," said Hepzibah, with a sad, hollow laugh. "But in old houses like this, you know, dead people are very apt to come back again."
"We shall see. And, Cousin Phoebe, since after all that I have said, your courage does not fail you,
we will not part so soon. You are welcome, my child, for the present, to such a home as your kinswoman can offer you."
With this measured but not exactly cold assurance of a hospitable purpose, Hepzibah kissed her cheek. They now went below stairs, where Phoebe, not so much assuming the office as attracting it to herself by the magnetism of innate fitness, took the most active part in preparing breakfast. The mistress of the house, meanwhile, as is usual with persons of her stiff and unmalleable cast, stood mostly aside, willing to lend her aid, yet conscious that her natural inaptitude would be likely to impede the business in hand. Phoebe and the fire that boiled the tea kettle were equally bright, cheerful, and efficient in their respective offices. Hepzibah gazed forth from her habitual sluggishness, the necessary result of long solitude, as from another sphere. She could not help being interested, however, and even amused, at the readiness with which her new inmate adapted herself to the circumstances, and brought the house, moreover, and all its rusty old appliances into a suitableness for her purposes. Whatever she did, too, was done without conscious effort, and with frequent outbreaks of song, which were exceedingly pleasant to the ear. This natural tunefulness made Phoebe seem like a bird in a shadowy tree, or conveyed the idea that the stream of life warbled through her heart, as a brook sometimes warbles through a pleasant little dell. It betokened the cheeriness of an active temperament, finding joy in its activity, and therefore rendering it beautiful. It was a New England trait, the stern old stuff of Puritanism with a gold thread in the web. Hepzibah brought out some old silver spoons with the family crest upon them and a china tea set painted over with grotesque figures of man, bird, and beast in as grotesque a landscape. These pictured people were odd humorists in a world of their own, a world of vivid brilliancy so far as color went, and still unfaded, although the teapot and small cups were as ancient as the custom itself of tea-drinking. "Your great-great-great-great-grandmother had these cups when she was married," said Hepzibah to Phoebe. "She was a Davenport of a good family. They were almost the first teacups ever seen in the colony, and if one of them were to be broken, my heart would break with it. But it is nonsense to speak so about a brittle teacup when I remember what my heart has gone through without breaking." The cups, not having been used, perhaps, since Hepzibah's youth, had contracted no small burden of dust, which Phoebe washed away with so much care and delicacy as to satisfy even the proprietor of this invaluable china. "What a nice little housewife you are!" exclaimed the latter, smiling, and at the same time frowning so prodigiously that the smile was sunshine under a thundercloud. "Do you do other things as well? Are you as good with your book as you are at washing teacups?" "Not quite, I am afraid," said Phoebe, laughing at the form of Hepzibah's question. "But I was schoolmistress for the little children in our district last summer, and might have been so still."
"Ah, 'tis all very well," observed the maiden lady, drawing herself up. "But these things must have come to you with your mother's blood. I never knew a pinchin that had any turn for them."
It is very queer, but not the less true, that people are generally quite as vain, or even more so, of their deficiencies than of their available gifts, as was Hepzibah of this native inapplicability, so to speak, of the pinchins to any useful purpose. She regarded it as an hereditary trait, and so perhaps it was, but unfortunately a morbid one, such as is often generated in families that remain long above the surface of society. Before they left the breakfast table, the shop bell rang sharply, and Hepzibah set down the remnant of her final cup of tea with a look of sallow despair that was truly piteous to behold. In cases of distasteful occupation, the second day is generally worse than the first. We return to the rack with all the soreness of the preceding torture in our limbs. At all events, Hepzibah had fully satisfied herself of the impossibility of ever becoming wonted to this peevishly obstreperous little bell. Ring as often as it might, the sound always smote upon her nervous system rudely and suddenly, and especially now, while with her crested teaspoons and antique china she was flattering herself with ideas of gentility, she felt an unspeakable disinclination to confront a customer.
"Do not trouble yourself, dear cousin," cried Phoebe, starting lightly up. "I am shopkeeper today."
"You, child!" exclaimed Hepzibah. "What can a little country girl know of such matters?"
"Oh, I have done all the shopping for the family at our village store," said Phoebe, "and I have had a table at a fancy fair and made better sales than anybody. These things are not to be learnt. They depend upon a knack that comes, I suppose, added she, smiling, with one's mother's blood. You shall see that I am as nice a little saleswoman as I am a housewife. The old gentlewoman stole behind Phoebe and peeped from the passageway into the shop to note how she would manage her undertaking. It was a case of some intricacy. A very ancient woman, in a white short gown and a green petticoat, with a string of gold beads about her neck and what looked like a nightcap on her head, had brought a quantity of yarn to barter for the commodities of the shop. She was probably the very last person in town who still kept the time-honored spinning wheel in constant revolution. It was worthwhile to hear the croaking and hollow tones of the old lady, and the pleasant voice of Phoebe mingling in one twisted thread of talk, and still better to contrast their figures, so light and bloomy, so decrepit and dusky, with only the counter betwixt them, in one sense, but more than 80 years in another. As for the bargain, it was wrinkled slyness and craft pitted against native truth and sagacity. "Was not that well done?" asked Phoebe, laughing when the customer was gone.
"Nicely done indeed, child," answered Hepzibah. "I could not have gone through with it nearly as well. As you say, it must be a knack that belongs to you on the mother's side."
It is a very genuine admiration, that with which persons too shy or too awkward to take a due part in the bustling world regard the real actors in life's stirring scenes. So genuine, in fact, that the former are usually fain to make it palatable to their self-love by assuming that these active and forceful qualities are incompatible with others, which they choose to deem higher and more important. Thus Hepzibah was well content to acknowledge Phoebe's vastly superior gifts as a shopkeeper. She listened with compliant ear to her suggestion of various methods whereby the influx of trade might be increased and rendered profitable without a hazardous outlay of capital. She consented that the village maiden should manufacture yeast, both liquid and in cakes, and should brew a certain kind of beer, nectarous to the palate, and of rare stomachic virtues, and moreover should bake and exhibit for sale some little spice cakes, which whosoever tasted would longingly desire to taste again. All such proofs of a ready mind and skillful handiwork were highly acceptable to the aristocratic huckstress, so long as she could murmur to herself with a grim smile and a half-natural sigh and a sentiment of mixed wonder, pity, and growing affection, "What a nice little body she is! If she could only be a lady, too! But that's impossible. Phoebe is no pinchin. She takes everything from her mother." As to Phoebe's not being a lady, or whether she were a lady or no, it was a point perhaps difficult to decide, but which could hardly have come up for judgment at all in any fair and healthy mind. Out of New England it would be impossible to meet with a person combining so many ladylike attributes with so many others that form no necessary, if compatible, part of the character. She shocked no canon of taste. She was admirably in keeping with herself, and never jarred against surrounding circumstances. Her figure, to be sure, so small as to be almost childlike, and so elastic that motion seemed as easy or easier to it than rest, would hardly have suited one's idea of a countess. Neither did her face, with the brown ringlets on either side, and the slightly piquant nose, and the wholesome bloom, and the clear shade of tan, and the half a dozen freckles, friendly remembrancers of the April sun and breeze, precisely give us a right to call her beautiful. But there was both luster and depth in her eyes. She was very pretty, as graceful as a bird, and graceful much in the same way, as pleasant about the house as a gleam of sunshine falling on the floor through a shadow of twinkling leaves, or as a ray of firelight that dances on the wall while evening is drawing nigh. Instead of discussing her claim to rank among ladies, it would be preferable to regard Phoebe as the example of feminine grace and availability, combined in a state of society, if there were any such, where ladies did not exist. There it should be woman's office to move in the midst of practical affairs, and to gild them all, the very homeliest, were it even the scouring of pots and kettles, with an atmosphere of loveliness and joy. Such was the sphere of Phoebe. To find the born and educated lady, on the other hand, we need look no farther than Hepzibah, our forlorn old maid, in her rustling and rusty silks, with a deeply cherished and ridiculous consciousness of long descent, her shadowy claims to princely territory, and, in the way of accomplishment, her recollections, it may be, of having formerly thrummed on a harpsichord and walked a minuet and worked an antique tapestry stitch on her sampler. It was a fair parallel between new plebeianism and old gentility. It really seemed as if the battered visage of the House of the Seven Gables, black and heavy-browed as it still certainly looked, must have shown a kind of cheerfulness glimmering through its dusky windows as Phoebe passed to and fro in the interior. Otherwise, it is impossible to explain how the people of the neighborhood so soon became aware of the girl's presence. There was a great run of custom, setting steadily in from about 10 o'clock until towards noon, relaxing somewhat at dinner time, but recommencing in the afternoon, and finally dying away a half an hour or so before the long day's sunset. One of the stanchest patrons was little Ned Higgins, the devourer of Jim Crow and the Elephant, who today had signalized his omnivorous prowess by swallowing 2 dromedaries and a locomotive. Phoebe laughed as she summed up her aggregate of sales upon the slate, while Hepzibah, first drawing on a pair of silk gloves, reckoned over the sordid accumulation of copper coin, not without silver intermixed, that had jingled into the till.
"We must renew our stock, Cousin Hepzibah," cried the little saleswoman.
"The gingerbread figures are all gone, and so are those Dutch wooden milkmaids, and most of our other playthings. There has been constant inquiry for cheap raisins, and a great cry for whistles and trumpets and jews' harps, and at least 12 little boys have asked for molasses candy, and we must contrive to get a peck of russet apples late in the season, as it is. But, dear cousin, what an enormous heap of copper! Positively a copper mountain!"
"Well done, well done, well done," quoth Uncle Venner,
who had taken occasion to shuffle in and out of the shop 7 times in the course of the day.
"Here's a girl that will never end her days at my farm. Bless my eyes, what a brisk little soul."
"Yes, Phoebe is a nice girl," said Hepzibah, with a scowl of austere approbation. "But, Uncle Venner, you have known the family a great many years. Can you tell me whether there ever was a Pynchon whom she takes after?"
"I don't believe there ever was," answered the venerable man. "At any rate, it never was my luck to see her like among them, nor for that matter anywhere else. I've seen a great deal of the world, not only in people's kitchens and backyards, but at the street corners and on the wharves, and in other places where my business calls me, and I'm free to say, Miss Hepzibah, that I never knew a human creature do her work so much like one of God's angels as this child Phoebe does."
Uncle Venner's eulogium, if it appear rather too high-strained for the person and the occasion, had nevertheless a sense in which it was both subtle and true. There was a spiritual quality in Phoebe's activity. The life of the long and busy day, spent in occupations that might so easily have taken a squalid and ugly aspect, had been made pleasant and even lovely by the spontaneous grace with which these homely duties seemed to bloom out of her character, so that labor, while she dealt with it, had the easy and flexible charm of play. Angels do not toil, but let their good works grow out of them, and so did Phoebe. The 2 relatives, the young maid and the old one, found time before nightfall, in the intervals of trade, to make rapid advances toward affection and confidence. A recluse, like Hepzibah, usually displays remarkable frankness, and at least temporary affability, on being absolutely cornered and brought to the point of personal intercourse. Like the angel whom Jacob wrestled with, she is ready to bless you when once overcome. The old gentlewoman took a dreary and proud satisfaction in leading Phoebe from room to room of the house, and recounting the traditions with which, as we may say, the walls were lugubriously frescoed. She showed the indentations made by the lieutenant governor's sword hilt in the door panels of the apartment where old Colonel Pynchon, a dead host, had received his affrighted visitors with an awful frown. The dusky terror of that frown, Hepzibah observed, was thought to be lingering ever since in the passageway.
She bade Phoebe step into one of the tall chairs and inspect the ancient map of the Pynchon territory at the eastward. In a tract of land on which she laid her finger, there existed a silver mine, the locality of which was precisely pointed out in some memoranda of Colonel Pynchon himself, but only to be made known when the family claim should be recognized by government. Thus it was for the interest of all New England that the Pynchon should have justice done them. She told, too, how that there was undoubtedly an immense treasure of English guineas hidden somewhere about the house or in the cellar, or possibly in the garden. "If you should happen to find it, Phoebe," said Hepzibah, glancing aside at her with a grim yet kindly smile, "we will tie up the shop bell for good and all."
"Yes, dear cousin," answered Phoebe. "But in the meantime, I hear somebody ringing it."
When the customer was gone, Hepzibah talked rather vaguely and at great length about a certain Alice Pynchon, who had been exceedingly beautiful and accomplished in her lifetime 100 years ago. The fragrance of her rich and delightful character still lingered about the place where she had lived, as a dried rosebud scents the drawer where it has withered and perished. This lovely Alice had met with some great and mysterious calamity, and had grown thin and white and gradually faded out of the world. But even now she was supposed to haunt the House of the Seven Gables. And a great many times, especially when one of the Pynchons was to die, she had been heard playing sadly and beautifully on the harpsichord. One of these tunes, just as it had sounded from her spiritual touch, had been written down by an amateur of music. It was so exquisitely mournful that nobody to this day could bear to hear it played unless when a great sorrow had made them know the still profounder sweetness of it.
"Was it the same harpsichord that you showed me?" inquired Phoebe.
"The very same," said Hepzibah. "It was Alice Pynchon's harpsichord. When I was learning music, my father would never let me open it, so, as I could only play on my teacher's instrument, I have forgotten all my music long ago."
Leaving these antique themes, the old lady began to talk about the daguerreotypist, whom, as he seemed to be a well-meaning and orderly young man, and in narrow circumstances, she had permitted to take up his residence in one of the Seven Gables. But on seeing more of Mr. Holgrave, she hardly knew what to make of him. He had the strangest companions imaginable. Men with long beards, and dressed in linen blouses, and other such newfangled and ill-fitting garments, reformers, temperance lecturers, and all manner of cross-looking philanthropists, community men and come-outers, as Hepzibah believed, who acknowledged no law and ate no solid food, but lived on the scent of other people's cookery and turned up their noses at the fair. As for the daguerreotypist, she had read a paragraph in a penny paper the other day, accusing him of making a speech full of wild and disorganizing matter at a meeting of his banditti-like associates. For her own part, she had reason to believe that he practiced animal magnetism, and if such things were in fashion nowadays, should be apt to suspect him of studying the black art up there in his lonesome chamber.
"But, dear cousin," said Phoebe, "if the young man is so dangerous, why do you let him stay? If he does nothing worse, he may set the house on fire."
"Why, sometimes," answered Hepzibah, "I have seriously made it a question whether I ought not to send him away. But with all his oddities, he is a quiet kind of person, and has such a way of taking hold of one's mind that without exactly liking him, for I don't know enough of the young man, I should be sorry to lose sight of him entirely. A woman clings to slight acquaintances when she lives so much alone as I do."
"But if Mr. Holgrave is a lawless person," remonstrated Phoebe, a part of whose essence it was to keep within the limits of law.
"Oh," said Hepzibah carelessly, for formal as she was, still in her life's experience, she had gnashed her teeth against human law, "I suppose he has a law of his own."
6. Maul's Well. After an early tea, the little country girl strayed into the garden. The enclosure had formerly been very extensive, but was now contracted within small compass, and hemmed about partly by high wooden fences, and partly by the outbuildings of houses that stood on another street. In its center was a grass plat, surrounding a ruinous little structure which showed just enough of its original design to indicate that it had once been a summer house. A hop vine springing from last year's root was beginning to clamber over it, but would be long in covering the roof with its green mantle. Three of the seven gables either fronted or looked sideways, with a dark solemnity of aspect, down into the garden. The black, rich soil had fed itself with the decay of a long period of time, such as fallen leaves, the petals of flowers, and the stalks and seed vessels of vagrant and lawless plants, more useful after their death than ever while flaunting in the sun. The evil of these departed years would naturally have sprung up again in such rank weeds, symbolic of the transmitted vices of society, as are always prone to root themselves about human dwellings. Phoebe saw, however, that their growth must have been checked by a degree of careful labor bestowed daily and systematically on the garden. The white double rosebush had evidently been propped up anew against the house since the commencement of the season, and a pear tree and three damson trees, which except for a row of currant bushes constituted the only varieties of fruit, bore marks of the recent amputation of several superfluous or defective limbs. There were also a few species of antique and hereditary flowers, in no very flourishing condition, but scrupulously weeded, as if some person, either out of love or curiosity, had been anxious to bring them to such perfection as they were capable of attaining. The remainder of the garden presented a well-selected assortment of esculent vegetables in a praiseworthy state of advancement, summer squashes almost in their golden blossom, cucumbers now evincing a tendency to spread away from the main stock and ramble far and wide, two or three rows of string beans, and as many more that were about to festoon themselves on poles, tomatoes, occupying a site so sheltered and sunny that the plants were already gigantic and promised an early and abundant harvest. Phoebe wondered whose care and toil it could have been that had planted these vegetables and kept the soil so clean and orderly. Not surely her cousin Hepzibah's, who had no taste nor spirits for the ladylike employment of cultivating flowers, and with her recluse habits and tendency to shelter herself within the dismal shadow of the house, would hardly have come forth under the speck of open sky to weed and hoe among the fraternity of beans and squashes. It being her first day of complete estrangement from rural objects, Phoebe found an unexpected charm in this little nook of grass and foliage and aristocratic flowers and plebeian vegetables. The eye of heaven seemed to look down into it pleasantly, and with a peculiar smile, as if glad to perceive that nature, elsewhere overwhelmed and driven out of the dusty town, had here been able to retain a breathing place. The spot acquired a somewhat wilder grace, and yet a very gentle one, from the fact that a pair of robins had built their nest in the pear tree, and were making themselves exceedingly busy and happy in the dark intricacy of its boughs. Bees, too, strange to say, had thought it worth their while to come hither, possibly from the range of hives beside some farmhouse miles away. How many aerial voyages might they have made, in quest of honey, or honey-laden, betwixt dawn and sunset? Yet late as it now was, there still arose a pleasant hum out of one or two of the squash blossoms, in the depths of which these bees were plying their golden labor. There was one other object in the garden which nature might fairly claim as her inalienable property, in spite of whatever man could do to render it his own. This was a fountain, set round with a rim of old mossy stones, and paved in its bed with what appeared to be a sort of mosaic work of variously colored pebbles. The play and slight agitation of the water in its upward gush wrought magically with these variegated pebbles, and made a continually shifting apparition of quaint figures, vanishing too suddenly to be definable. Thence, swelling over the rim of moss-grown stones, the water stole away under the fence, through what we regret to call a gutter rather than a channel. Nor must we forget to mention a hen-coop of very reverend antiquity that stood in the farther corner of the garden, not a great way from the fountain. It now contained only Chanticleer, his two wives, and a solitary chicken. All of them were pure specimens of a breed which had been transmitted down as an heirloom in the Pynchon family, and were said, while in their prime, to have attained almost the size of turkeys, and, on the score of delicate flesh, to be fit for a prince's table. In proof of the authenticity of this legendary renown, Hepzibah could have exhibited the shell of a great egg which an ostrich need hardly have been ashamed of. Be that as it might, the hens were now scarcely larger than pigeons, and had a queer, rusty, withered aspect, and a gouty kind of movement, and a sleepy and melancholy tone, throughout all the variations of their clucking and cackling. It was evident that the race had degenerated, like many a noble race besides, in consequence of too strict a watchfulness to keep it pure. These feathered people had existed too long in their distinct variety, a fact of which the present representatives, judging by their lugubrious deportment, seemed to be aware. They kept themselves alive, unquestionably, and laid now and then an egg and hatched a chicken, not for any pleasure of their own, but that the world might not absolutely lose what had once been so admirable a breed of fowls. The distinguishing mark of the hens was a crest of lamentably scanty growth in these latter days, but so oddly and wickedly analogous to Hepzibah's turban that Phoebe, to the poignant distress of her conscience, but inevitably, was led to fancy a general resemblance betwixt these forlorn bipeds and her respectable relative. The girl ran into the house to get some crumbs of bread, cold potatoes, and other such scraps as were suitable to the accommodating appetite of fowls. Returning, she gave a peculiar call, which they seemed to recognize. The chicken crept through the pails of the coop and ran, with some show of liveliness, to her feet, while Chanticleer and the ladies of his household regarded her with queer sidelong glances, and then croaked one to another, as if communicating their sage opinions of her character. So wise as well as antique was their aspect as to give color to the idea not merely that they were the descendants of a time-honored race, but that they had existed in their individual capacity ever since the House of the Seven Gables was founded, and were somehow mixed up with its destiny. They were a species of tutelary sprite, or banshee, although winged and feathered differently from most other guardian angels. "Here, you odd little chicken," said Phoebe. "Here are some nice crumbs for you." The chicken, hereupon, though almost as venerable in appearance as its mother, possessing indeed the whole antiquity of its progenitors in miniature, mustered vivacity enough to flutter upward and alight on Phoebe's shoulder. "That little fowl pays you a high compliment," said a voice behind Phoebe. Turning quickly, she was surprised at sight of a young man, who had found access into the garden by a door opening out of another gable than that whence she had emerged. He held a hoe in his hand, and while Phoebe was gone in quest of the crumbs, had begun to busy himself with drawing up fresh earth about the roots of the tomatoes. "The chicken really treats you like an old acquaintance," continued he in a quiet way, while a smile made his face pleasanter than Phoebe at first fancied it. "Those venerable personages in the coop, too, seem very affably disposed. You are lucky to be in their good graces so soon. They have known me much longer, but never honor me with any familiarity, though hardly a day passes without my bringing them food. Miss Hepzibah, I suppose, will interweave the fact with her other traditions and set it down that the fowls know you to be a Pynchon."
"The secret is," said Phoebe, smiling, "that I have learned how to talk with hens and chickens."
"Ah, but these hens," answered the young man, "these hens of aristocratic lineage would scorn to understand the vulgar language of a barnyard fowl. I prefer to think, and so would Miss Hepzibah, that they recognize the family tone. For you are a Pynchon?"
"My name is Phoebe Pynchon," said the girl, with a manner of some reserve, for she was aware that her new acquaintance could be no other than the daguerreotypist, of whose lawless propensities the old maid had given her a disagreeable idea. "I did not know that my cousin Hepzibah's garden was under another person's care."
"Yes," said Holgrave, "I dig and hoe and weed in this black old earth for the sake of refreshing myself with what little nature and simplicity may be left in it after men have so long sown and reaped here. I turn up the earth by way of pastime.
My sober occupation, so far as I have any, is with a lighter material. In short, I make pictures out of sunshine. And, not to be too much dazzled with my own trade, I have prevailed with Miss Hepzibah to let me lodge in one of these dusky gables. It is like a bandage over one's eyes to come into it. But would you like to see a specimen of my productions? A daguerreotype likeness, do you mean? Asked Phoebe with less reserve, for in spite of prejudice, her own youthfulness sprang forward to meet his. I don't much like pictures of that sort. They're so hard and stern. Besides dodging away from the eye and trying to escape altogether, they're conscious of looking very unamiable, I suppose, and therefore hate to be seen. If you would permit me, said the artist, looking at Phoebe, I should like to try whether the daguerreotype can bring out disagreeable traits on a perfectly amiable face. But there certainly is truth in what you have said. Most of my likenesses do look unamiable. But the very sufficient reason, I fancy, is because the originals are so. There is a wonderful insight in heaven's broad and simple sunshine. While we give it credit only for depicting the merest surface, it actually brings out the secret character, with a truth that no painter would ever venture upon, even could he detect it. There is at least no flattery in my humble line of art. Now here is a likeness which I have taken over and over again, and still with no better result. Yet the original wears, to common eyes, a very different expression. It would gratify me to have your judgment on this character. He exhibited a daguerreotype miniature in a Morocco case. Phoebe merely glanced at it and gave it back. I know the face, she replied, for its stern eye has been following me about all day. It is my Puritan ancestor who hangs yonder in the parlour. To be sure, you have found some way of copying the portrait without its black velvet cap and grey beard, and have given him a modern coat and satin cravat instead of his cloak and band. I don't think him improved by your alterations. You would have seen other differences had you looked a little longer, said Holgrave, laughing, yet apparently much struck. I can assure you that this is a modern face, and one which you will very probably meet. Now, the remarkable point is that the original wears to the world's eye, and for aught I know to his most intimate friends, an exceedingly pleasant countenance, indicative of benevolence, openness of heart, sunny good humour, and other praiseworthy qualities of that cast. The sun, as you see, tells quite another story, and will not be coaxed out of it after half a dozen patient attempts on my part. Here we have the man, sly, subtle, hard, imperious, and withal cold as ice. Look at that eye. Would you like to be at its mercy? At that mouth? Could it ever smile? And yet, if you could only see the benign smile of the original, it is so much the more unfortunate as he is a public character of some eminence, and the likeness was intended to be engraved. "'Well, I don't wish to see it any more,' observed Phoebe, turning away her eyes. "'It is certainly very like the old portrait. "'But my cousin Hepzibah has another picture, a miniature. "'If the original is still in the world, I think he might defy the sun "'to make him look stern and hard.' "'You have seen that picture, then?' exclaimed the artist, "'with an expression of much interest. "'I never did, but have a great curiosity to do so.' "'And you judge favourably of the face?' "'There never was a sweeter one,' said Phoebe. "'It is almost too soft and gentle for a man's.' "'Is there nothing wild in the eye?' continued Holgrave, "'so earnestly that it embarrassed Phoebe, "'as did also the quiet freedom with which he presumed on their so recent acquaintance. "'Is there nothing dark or sinister anywhere? "'Could you not conceive the original to have been guilty of a great crime?' "'It is nonsense,' said Phoebe, a little impatiently, "'for us to talk about a picture which you have never seen. "'You mistake it for some other. "'A crime, indeed. "'Since you are a friend of my cousin Hepzibah's, "'you should ask her to show you the picture.' "'It will suit my purpose still better to see the original,' "'replied the daguerreotypist coolly. "'As to his character, we need not discuss its points. "'They have already been settled by a competent tribunal.' "'or one which called itself competent. "'But stay, do not go yet, if you please. "'I have a proposition to make you.' "'Phoebe was on the point of retreating, "'but turned back with some hesitation, "'for she did not exactly comprehend his manner.'
although on better observation, its feature seemed rather to be lack of ceremony than any approach to offensive rudeness. There was an odd kind of authority, too, in what he now proceeded to say, rather as if the garden were his own than a place to which he was admitted merely by Hepzibah's courtesy. "If agreeable to you," he observed, "it would give me pleasure to turn over these flowers and those ancient and respectable fowls to your care. Coming fresh from country air and occupations, you will soon feel the need of some such out-of-door employment. My own sphere does not so much lie among flowers. You can trim and tend them, therefore, as you please, and I will ask only the least trifle of a blossom now and then in exchange for all the good, honest kitchen vegetables with which I propose to enrich Miss Hepzibah's table. So we will be fellow laborers, somewhat on the community system." Silently, and rather surprised at her own compliance, Phoebe accordingly betook herself to weeding a flower-bed, but busied herself still more with cogitations respecting this young man, with whom she so unexpectedly found herself on terms approaching to familiarity. She did not altogether like him. His character perplexed the little country girl, as it might a more practiced observer, for while the tone of his conversation had generally been playful, the impression left on her mind was that of gravity, and except as his youth modified it, almost sternness. She rebelled, as it were, against a certain magnetic element in the artist's nature, which he exercised towards her, possibly without being conscious of it. After a little while, the twilight, deepened by the shadows of the fruit trees and the surrounding buildings, threw an obscurity over the garden.
"There," said Holgrave, "it is time to give over work. That last stroke of the hoe has cut off a beanstalk.
Good night, Miss Phoebe Pynchon. Any bright day, if you will put one of those rosebuds in your hair and come to my rooms in Central Street, I will seize the purest ray of sunshine and make a picture of the flower and its wearer." He retired towards his own solitary gable, but turned his head on reaching the door and called to Phoebe, with a tone which certainly had laughter in it, yet which seemed to be more than half in earnest.
"Be careful not to drink at Maul's Well," said he. "Neither drink nor bathe your face in it."
"Maul's Well?" answered Phoebe. "Is that it with the rim of mossy stones? I have no thought of drinking there, but why not?"
"Oh," rejoined the daguerreotypist, "because, like an old lady's cup of tea, it is water bewitched."
He vanished, and Phoebe, lingering a moment, saw a glimmering light, and then the steady beam of a lamp in a chamber of the gable. On returning into Hepzibah's apartment of the house, she found the low-studded parlour so dim and dusky that her eyes could not penetrate the interior. She was indistinctly aware, however, that the gaunt figure of the old gentlewoman was sitting in one of the straight-backed chairs, a little withdrawn from the window, the faint gleam of which showed the blanched paleness of her cheek turned sideways towards a corner.
"Shall I light a lamp, Cousin Hepzibah?" she asked.
"Do, if you please, my dear child," answered Hepzibah. "But put it on the table in the corner of the passage. My eyes are weak, and I can seldom bear the lamplight on them."
What an instrument is the human voice! How wonderfully responsive to every emotion of the human soul!
In Hepzibah's tone at that moment there was a certain rich depth and moisture, as if the words, commonplace as they were, had been steeped in the warmth of her heart. Again, while lighting the lamp in the kitchen, Phoebe fancied that her cousin spoke to her.
"In a moment, cousin," answered the girl. "These matches just glimmer and go out."
But instead of a response from Hepzibah, she seemed to hear the murmur of an unknown voice. It was strangely indistinct, however, and less like articulate words than an unshaped sound, such as would be the utterance of feeling and sympathy rather than of the intellect. So vague was it that its impression, or echo, in Phoebe's mind was that of unreality. She concluded that she must have mistaken some other sound for that of the human voice, or else that it was altogether in her fancy. She set the lighted lamp in the passage and again entered the parlour. Hepzibah's form, though its sable outline mingled with the dusk,
was now less imperfectly visible. In the remoter parts of the room, however, its walls being so ill adapted to reflect light, there was nearly the same obscurity as before.
"Cousin," said Phoebe, "did you speak to me just now?"
"No, child," replied Hepzibah.
Fewer words than before, but with the same mysterious music in them. Mellow, melancholy, yet not mournful, the tone seemed to gush up out of the deep well of Hepzibah's heart, all steeped in its profoundest emotion. There was a tremor in it, too, that, as all strong feeling is electric, partly communicated itself to Phoebe. The girl sat silently for a moment, but soon, her senses being very acute, she became conscious of an irregular respiration in an obscure corner of the room. Her physical organization, moreover, being at once delicate and healthy, gave her a perception, operating with almost the effect of a spiritual medium, that somebody was near at hand.
"My dear cousin," asked she,
overcoming an indefinable reluctance,
"is there not someone in the room with us?"
"Phoebe, my dear little girl," said Hepzibah, after a moment's pause, "you were up betimes and have been busy all day. Pray go to bed, for I am sure you must need rest. I will sit in the parlor a while and collect my thoughts. It has been my custom for more years, child, than you have lived."
While thus dismissing her, the maiden lady stepped forward, kissed Phoebe, and pressed her to her heart, which beat against the girl's bosom with a strong, high, and tumultuous swell. How came there to be so much love in this desolate old heart that it could afford to well over thus abundantly?
"Good night, cousin," said Phoebe, strangely affected by Hepzibah's manner. "If you begin to love me, I am glad."
She retired to her chamber, but did not soon fall asleep, nor then very profoundly. At some uncertain period in the depths of night, and, as it were, through the thin veil of a dream, she was conscious of a footstep mounting the stairs heavily, but not with force and decision. The voice of Hepzibah, with a hush through it, was going up along with the footsteps, and again